Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It is Monday, June the 11th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. We can do it together. Just visit norml.org to get involved today. We have an excellent lineup of guests for you this week here on the Audio Stash. We'll speak with Kevin Zeese and Doug McVeigh of Common Sense for Drug Policy about their websites and their work out there. We'll also speak with Cliff Thornton of EfficacyOnline.org. Cliff ran for governor of Connecticut last year. Also on the program this week in political figures, we'll speak with Member of Parliament from Vancouver, British Columbia, Libby Davies, who's questioning the new conservative drug policy in Canada right now. Also on the program tomorrow, Democratic presidential contender Mike Gravel, who's made some very strong statements calling for the legalization of marijuana. That's all this week right here on the Audio Stash, and today we'll speak with Matt Simon of New Hampshire Citizens for Common Sense Marijuana Policy, and we'll also speak with Sasha Abramski about his book American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. We spoke with Sasha last week here on the Audio Stash. We're presenting part two today. And make sure to link up if you didn't catch our hour-long one-year anniversary special. We have the MP3 link to that right up on our homepage at normalaudiostash.com.
What's up, guys? This is Miss High Times 2007, and you're chilling with us here at the Normal Podcast.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming.
As the presidential primaries heat up, one of the traditional and still very important early battlegrounds for politicians is the live free or die state of New Hampshire. Politicians seeking the presidency will be out kissing babies, shaking hands, and getting a lot of questions about marijuana. Joining us today from New Hampshire is one of the people asking the marijuana question, Matt Simon. He's with the New Hampshire Coalition for Common Sense Marijuana Policy, and they have a new website online called sendtherightmessage.com, where they are tracking the presidential hopeful's views on marijuana policy. Matt, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Thank you, Chris.
Great to speak with you today, Matt. I'm really excited about this website and what you guys are doing there in New Hampshire. First, tell us where the idea for the website sendtherightmessage.com came about and what kinds of activities you're participating in.
We come at this, you know, at NH Common Sense from the perspective of a state-level organization that's trying to bring about a change in state marijuana policies. And after 6 months of working on a decriminalization issue and also medical marijuana, it became obvious that many of our state legislators are just simply afraid of the federal government intruding in New Hampshire's internal affairs We think the power to decide for New Hampshire should reside in our state government, where people can actually participate, and that's a popular theoretical position in New Hampshire, as well as many other states. So in addition to that, I think we're realizing that change has to come from the people themselves. We can't, you know, just sit around and hope one of the national organizations can pull off some kind of miracle inside the Beltway, where miracles seem to be few and far between these days. State and local groups have to take some initiative, and I'm proud of the respect we've garnered already with the media in New Hampshire. I'm hoping we can translate that into some success with our new campaign to affect the presidential primary process.
And Matt, I've never been up to New Hampshire for the primary season, but it seems like everyone really gets a fair amount of face time with these presidential candidates.
We absolutely do. If that's your sort of thing, it's like being a kid in a candy store. They're here a lot. Just last week, I was able to score press passes for both of the presidential debates. I was able to meet with Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel after the Democratic debate. I was able to shake hands with the red hot Ron Paul after the Republican debate Tuesday. And, you know, we do plan to gather and publish information on all the candidates, but at this early stage, what I'm finding myself and the people we're working with to be most interested in is identifying the candidates who were against prohibition and, you know, the ones who have demonstrated a willingness to speak out against at least the excesses of prohibition, if not the whole enchilada. So I'm hoping that cannabis activists will see fit to look at these candidates and learn more about them and perhaps choose to support one of them rather than remaining apathetic in what I think is going to be a really important election here.
Now, Matt, we've had Ron Paul here on the Audio Stash for interviews twice so far. Let me ask what you think of his candidacy, because I think he's shown himself to be a real contender here.
Yeah, Ron Paul has already done what would have been unthinkable 2 months ago. He's broken through into a wave of major media attention, and you know, the debate where he confronted Rudy Giuliani on foreign policy was what started that, and the Bill Maher appearance was a big boost for him. But Monday night he was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and that was 7 minutes that I thought I would never see. You know, I've been aware of Texas Congressman Ron Paul for a long time, and he's toiled in obscurity throughout much of his career, and he's been marginalized, of course, within his own party. You know, remember, he's the one Republican who opposed the war in Iraq before it started, and he's, of course, a total anti-prohibitionist. So now that he's gained through and really, you know, broken through and gained a piece of the spotlight, it could be a really unique vehicle who will take the anti-prohibitionist message to a different constituency and bring, you know, the Constitution back into the discussion along with the classic principles of American liberty, which have been so badly tarnished by decades of prohibition. I mean, the Republican Party is so fractured right now, and you know, Ron Paul has made it his personal mission, I think, to re-educate Republicans about liberty and the Constitution, and hopefully through that process he'll be able to convince a lot of people who don't like marijuana, don't ever want to see it or have anything to do with it, that they should still respect the liberty of their fellow American.
Now, how about the rest of the candidates up there? How have they fared in the New Hampshire meet and greets? Have you seen any really flop and fail yet?
Well, I don't think the people in New Hampshire are happy with any of the top-tier candidates. That is what I see just repeatedly. I mean, the number of independents in New Hampshire and across the country has been increasing steadily over the last few decades, and the people are fed up with the establishment of both parties. They seem to be working together not part of it is not wanting to discuss issues like drug policy at all, trying to sweep them completely under the rug. People understand that 2.3 million people in jail or whatever it is a serious problem, and we need to do something about it. So I think people are looking to the second-tier candidates and the third-tier candidates to see if anybody can rise up, and I sense a lot of open-mindedness and a lot of dissatisfaction with all the top-tier candidates.
Also, Matt, on the website sendtherightmessage.com, you're tracking any comments the presidential candidates have made about marijuana in the campaign. And a recent post involved Rudy Giuliani. Tell us what's happening with him.
That was something that I just linked to, but apparently somebody from another group asked him about medical marijuana, and he said, you know, this was in conjunction with Tuesday night. He opened the debate with saying how much he liked the New Hampshire state motto and live free or die, and how he thought that was a great way to think. And there's an effort in the Republican Party to kind of paint him as a little bit of a libertarian, which isn't anywhere in his record and is actually kind of funny to some of us who know his positions on things like medical marijuana. I don't know what his exact position is, but in conjunction with him trying to claim that he's a live-free-or-die kind of guy, not allowing patients and doctors to determine what constitutes medicine in an individual circumstance is not live-free-or-die.
Matt, you recently interviewed former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. Senator Gravel will actually be here on the Audio Stash with us tomorrow. You know, let me know what your impressions were of him.
Indeed. He's a very remarkable individual. He's been out of politics, I think, for over 20 years, and that it's hard to show up out of nowhere and make a serious push for the presidency. And, you know, his main purpose in being there is to speak out against the war and to make the case that Congress does have the power to defund the war, which is what he did when he was in the Senate to help end the Vietnam War. That's the historical relevance of Mike Gravel, but I'm very happy to find out that he's a total anti-prohibitionist and told me and anybody else that would listen. Nobody's asking him these questions, by the way. This is what he lamented to me afterwards, was that if he wants to talk about the war on drugs, he has to take another question and make it into something about the war on drugs, because nobody's asking him about drug prohibition, and that's exactly what needs to change. Every time a person like that is in a public forum, they should be given opportunities and thanked afterwards for telling the truth.
And talking about getting the marijuana policy question at all, it does seem sometimes like mainstream journalists have all but forgotten about our failed prohibition policies.
I would suggest that one of the reasons that journalists have forgotten about the issue is that citizens aren't raising the issue effectively enough, and these candidate forums are one example. If you have people packing in 100 people to see Hillary Clinton 10 times in New Hampshire, and you're a reporter, and you're there, and nobody of all the questions that get asked to Hillary Clinton, and none of them are about the war on drugs, none of them are about cannabis or marijuana, why would you think that's a big issue and something worth reporting? So there has to be demonstrated public support, and it has to be, you know, the kind of responsible public support that resonates well with people, not the other kind.
And Matt, what do you think is the best way to bring up these issues with politicians? Is it recreational use, medical access? You know, what's the best approach to get them to explore the issue publicly?
Well, that's a very interesting question. That kind of gets to the core of, you know, the debate between whether we should be radical and stand on principle or whether we should be incrementalists and try to pick the low-hanging fruit. It's something I've thought about quite a lot. You know, I think in the course of being an activist that there are times when it's totally appropriate to seek small increments of change, and I think there are times when it's more important to take a more firm stand on principle. And right now I think prohibition is a tree that just has a lot of low-hanging fruit, and the question is how to get it down. Where we are right now, I think it's the whole prohibition tree, a good coordinated shake. If we can shake the tree, the low-hanging fruit, like medical marijuana, will hopefully just simply fall to earth. And if we can undermine public support for the federal war on drugs, the drug warriors, you know, they have no choice but to give up ground on issues such as medical marijuana, and not to mention their ridiculous ban on industrial hemp farming and things like that. That's when you're able to make progress against something, then the enemy should to retreat somewhat and retrench to maintain their position. And I think with groups like Law Enforcement Against Prohibition making the more radical and scholarly argument, but of course being police officers, is the type of thing that if it's trickled up into the mainstream media will shake confidence in prohibition. Because lately I've been trying to talk to people about medical marijuana, and I'm talking mainstream kind of people, regular people, and you say medical marijuana, and they half the time come back and say, you know what, this whole war on drugs is a great big mess, isn't it? So I'm not going to be afraid to raise the more scholarly kinds of Milton Friedman, William F. Buckley, or, you know, any other scholar that's truly studied the issue. Those arguments against prohibition are powerful, and we shouldn't be afraid to make them. If you prohibit any substance, you're going to get nasty side effects from prohibition. The question is, you know, are so nasty that they need to be prohibited, and maybe they are, but we're arguing that cannabis certainly doesn't fit that category, and I think it's a consistent argument. There is a fundamental difference between cannabis and crystal meth.
And Matt, what's next for you guys there at sendtherightmessage.com? What are the next events you'll be at?
Well, we're keeping our eyes on the calendar. I'm really looking at it on a candidate-to-candidate and event-by-event basis. What kind of event is it? Is it a little meet-and-greet at the country store down the road where I might be able to shake a candidate's hand and ask him a question, or is it a public forum? But, you know, Bill Richardson's one candidate that I'm looking to speak to the next time he's in town, and that's stemming from his strong support for medical marijuana. He said in Iowa that nobody even mentioned it or asked him about it, and I think that's a mistake. This is a candidate who's rising up into the top tier in the Democratic on the Democratic side of things, and he took a strong position in favor of medical marijuana legislation in New Mexico. If we had that kind of leadership in New Hampshire from our governor, we'd have easily passed our medical marijuana this bill. You know, Governor Richardson was calling legislators and using his influence and signed the bill. So I think that's something that we all ought to be thanking him for and telling people about.
Well, Matt, this has been a great conversation here today, and I very much look forward to speaking with you again as the presidential races move forward here.
All right. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks again, Matt. Matt Simon is with the New Hampshire Coalition for Common Sense Marijuana Policy. They have a new website called sendtherightmessage.com. We'll have links to it at normalaudiostash.com today.
Hey, how's it going? My name's Will. I don't work at a used record store. I don't own an iguana, although I'm sure they make great pets. I don't have dreadlocks or play the acoustic guitar. I can remember quite well, thank you, and no, I don't constantly have the munchies. When 420 comes around, I've still got 40 minutes of work left. I've never hit a girl on a bike with my car or shot my friend with a shotgun. I've never had to apologize for letting a girl I was watching drown in a pool while I was getting high because, duh, I wouldn't be getting high if I was around children. I'm a regular guy who works regular jobs, just like the majority of all Americans who use marijuana occasionally and responsibly. My name is Will, and I'm normal.
This is Sojas, Soldiers of Jarmy, and you're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Big up yourself.
Last week on the Audio Stash, we spoke with author Sasha Abramski about his newest book, American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. In the first part of our interview, Sasha and I focused on the overall issue of America's epidemic incarceration rates and the racial disparity of incarceration. In American Furies, Sasha interviewed hundreds of prisoners and prison officials. And in part two of our interview today, we focus on how marijuana prohibition is particularly incorporated into this problem. We have links to the book, American Furies, at our website, normalaudiostash.com. Sasha, welcome back to the Audio Stash today. Thanks again for the second interview.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Now, Sasha, in your research for American Furies, how much did you encounter marijuana prohibition contributing to America's prison population?
Well, it's a part of a much larger problem. What you see happening is in many states, habitual offender laws have been written in the last 10 to 15 years, let's say. And it's the habitual offender laws that seem to be having the biggest impact on marijuana offenders, because what you're seeing is an increasing number of people who, on their third strike, are striking out not for serious crimes, but they're striking out for low-end drug possession offenses. And many of them are marijuana. The example in my book that I use is I went to Alabama several years back to a prison that housed a lot of life-sentenced inmates, and I met three or four men, middle-aged men, who under the habitual offender statutes had been sentenced to life incarceration on marijuana charges. More recently, I went down to a federal penitentiary called Lompoc in Southern California in the mountains near Santa Barbara, and I interviewed a young man called Weldon Angelos, and he'd been arrested in Salt Lake City for drug dealing, for marijuana dealing. And the informant who snitched on him claimed, without producing photographic evidence, but he claimed that Weldon Angelos had a gun in an ankle holster when he sold the drugs. And the federal government came in because they're sentencing enhancements for dealing drugs and carrying a gun. Federal government came in, and Weldon Angelos got several decades behind bars in a federal penitentiary for marijuana dealing. He's going to spend the rest of his life basically in prison. So you do see the story where drugs is leading to incarceration for long periods of time. What's more common, though, is in cities like New York, where misdemeanor arrests for marijuana possession and marijuana smoking are going up. Now, those aren't resulting in jail time, and they're not resulting in prison time, but they are resulting in people getting misdemeanor records, and that stays with somebody for the rest of their life. It's on their criminal record. It impacts their ability to get credit, their ability to get jobs, and so on. So in New York, even though these young marijuana users generally don't go to prison or to jail, they are having their life impacted fairly significantly by the street sweeps that are going on in New York.
And when we talk about those mandatory minimums and the three strikes laws that you mentioned, if it weren't for mandatory minimums, if it weren't for these three strikes laws that are out there, would we have less of a prison population, or are they major contributors to this?
Oh, absolutely. We have 2.2 million people who on any given day are going to wake up and they're either in jail or they're in prison. That's one in 100 of our adult population at this point lives behind bars. And that's five times higher than was the case in our recent past, maybe 30 years ago, before the war on drugs really kicked in. And when you look at the numbers, you find that increasingly it's the low-end drug-related offenses that are now carrying prison time, and long prison time at that. If you took the war on drugs out of the equation, we'd still have a large prison population, but it would be far more in keeping with that of other countries. What makes our prison system unique in size at the moment is the war on drugs. Now, to give a sense of what's happening here, if you analyze government statistics, statistics generated by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, you'll see that one in three state cases that go through the court system at this point are drug cases. About 20% of all cases are drug dealing, and about 12% are drug possession. And that's a staggering number of people. That means that there are hundreds of thousands of people being run through the correctional mill almost exclusively because of their involvement with drugs.
And this incarceration approach, you know, how much has this system in America affected other countries?
In my book, I talk about what I call incarceration hedonism. And it's this idea that if it feels good politically, if we have an itch to incarcerate, let's say you scratch that itch. And the reason we do that is because we're an extremely wealthy country and we're very impatient with limits. And I think what's happened over the last 20, 25 years, increasingly our public policy has been framed around the notion that imprisonment is going to form a central part of who we are as a society. And it's going to cost a lot. It costs about $50,000 a year in some states per inmate to incarcerate them. We're now spending about $100 billion a year, which is a staggeringly large amount of money. $100 billion a year nationally is now being spent running our various prisons and jails and federal penitentiaries and so on. You can only do that if you've got an extraordinary amount of wealth to play around with. Most countries just do not have those resources. And the other countries that are close to us in resources, the countries that really are fairly affluent, other first world countries, have chosen different priorities. So you see, for example, in Scandinavia, tremendous investments in public infrastructure, in social welfare, in programs that actually impact poverty, and in impacting poverty, lower the accompanying crime rate, because oftentimes crime is a product of poverty. In America, we have the money, but we're not channeling the money into social investment. We're channeling the money instead into social control, and there's a big difference. And what that means is that as a society, we're no longer willing to invest in social infrastructure or social capital to the extent that we need to the extent that we used to do in our own past. But we are willing as a society to spend a lot of money dealing with the dysfunction and the pathologies that accompany poverty. And that, to me, is a real change in priorities. It's a real change in who we are as a country and in what our social values are.
And do you think that prohibition has affected, you know, our American view of our own society, do you think?
Well, I think there's this really complicated interplay between the criminal world and the non-criminal world, and the values of each ricochet back off of each other. And when I was doing research for my book, I talked to a lot of corrections experts, people who'd a lot of times worked for many, many decades as prison wardens or prison administrators or people in charge of entire state prison systems. And I was most struck by the comments, I think, of a man called Jim Estelle, who was the one-time head of the entire correctional system in Texas. And he said to me, look, don't kid yourself. Prisons are just a microcosm of the broader society. Prisons reflect the values of the broader society. And when the broader society decides that there are certain groups and individuals and categories that it doesn't want to deal with on the outside, then we, as prison officials, he said, get left with those people. That, in a sense, prisons become the dumping ground for society's problems. Now, obviously, there are some people who, you know, under any conceivable social framework, they're going to go to prison. a Charles Manson is going to go to prison, whether he's in America today, whether he's in America 30 years ago, whether he's in Sweden today. But the prison system is not filled with Charles Mansons. That's a small percentage of the total population. Increasingly, the population of prisoners are social misfits, drug addicts, the homeless, the mentally ill, neighborhood nuisances. Those are the ones who are swelling the prison system to its abnormal size. And in most societies, the social value system doesn't promote that kind of wholesale incarceration. So I do think that this is a story about our values as a country and our priorities as a country, as much as it's a story about straightforward crime and punishment and criminal justice theory.
Sasha, you mentioned that not just race, but class is an important component to this issue of American prisons. You know, is it just the case that some are just too poor to litigate themselves out of going to prison?
Well, to a degree, that is the case, that the wealthier you are, the more you can access A-grade lawyers. And if you have the best lawyers in the business, you've got a much better shot at eventually getting out of prison or getting a sort of stay-out-of-prison card, if you like. But I think the more fundamental issue here is not the legal representation. The more fundamental issue is just that overwhelmingly the people who commit crimes are poor, undereducated. Because of the history of this country, there's a tremendous overlap between race and class, so a disproportionate number of the people who commit crimes and get arrested tend to be non-white. And you see this in the prison system. The prison system is about 50% African-American, is disproportionately poor. About a third of the inmates are functionally illiterate. About 25% of the inmates are seriously mentally ill. You see this very, very depressing data that really is reflective of the broader, deeper societal divisions in our country. And that shouldn't really be a surprise. Most crimes aren't crimes committed by psychopaths like Charles Manson. Most crimes are crimes that in some way relate to poverty, whether it's burglary, robbery, low-level drug dealing, prostitution. These tend to be the crimes that are committed disproportionately by poor people. And so it really isn't a surprise that our prison systems, in a sense, have become somewhat equivalent to the Victorian-era workhouses. They really are, at this point, dumping grounds for our underclasses.
And Sasha, the book you authored before this one, before American Furies, is called Conned: How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. So, you know, with 2 million citizens in jail or prison each day, how much has this issue affected the political fabric of the country?
Oh, to a tremendous degree. In my book last year, I was talking about the phenomenon of felon disenfranchisement. And what that is a series of state laws that take away the voting right from somebody with a felony record. Different states do it in different ways. In some states, you lose the right to vote just while you're in prison. In other states, you lose it while you're in prison, on parole, on probation. But then there's this clutch of states, most of them in the Deep South, the old Confederate states, where if you get a felony conviction, to all intents and purposes, unless you jump through an extraordinary number of hoops, that's it. You're never going to vote again. It's a permanent disenfranchisement. So today, we have 5 million people nationally in America who can't vote because of their felony records. And in Florida alone, Florida is the sort of epicenter of disenfranchisement. The best guessed estimates are that there's between 750,000 and 1 million people who have been told by their own state government that they cannot vote. That's about 9% of the Florida electorate. So it's an absolutely staggering number of people. And it plays out in a very concrete way, given the fact that most people who are disenfranchised are poor, given the fact a disproportionate number are African-American, given the fact a disproportionate number come from big cities. All of this means that in the end, the pool of likely Democratic voters has been shrunk over the last 25 years as our prison population has gone up. And what that does is it skews the electorate in a statistically significant manner. By 2 or 3%, it skews the electorate in a more Republican direction than it would otherwise be. And you see the results of that in Florida as the most obvious case. In 2000, this nail-biter of an election between Al Gore and George Bush, it's decided ultimately by a few hundred votes in Florida. And at the same time, several hundred thousand people have been told they cannot vote. So it plays out in extremely concrete ways.
Now, Sasha, in American Furies, you offer some solutions to this incarceration epidemic. You know, tell us about some of these solutions out there.
Well, I mean, coming back to the question of drugs, without getting into the arguments around whether or not we should prioritize the attacks on drugs to the extent that we do, let's say that's entirely rational. Let's say that drugs are every bit as disturbing and every bit as destructive of our communal structure as the most hardcore drug warriors say. Let's say that's a given. The question then becomes, how do you deal with that most effectively? And there's an array of evidence out there at the moment, some of it gathered by public health experts, some of it gathered by think tanks like the RAND Corporation, that says you get much bigger bang for your buck if you turn this into a public health issue, if you deal with it as a treatment-oriented issue rather than a punishment-oriented issue. And so one of the most obvious things that can be done, for example, is setting up preemptive drug treatment systems so people can access state-funded drug treatment programs before they get arrested and put into the criminal justice system. Another thing that can be done is move towards a harm reduction model. And a harm reduction model, simplifying it, but it basically says drugs exist, they are a bad thing, but they exist and we have to deal with that reality. How do we deal with it in a way that causes the least harm? Now, incarceration causes a tremendous amount of harm. It rips families apart, takes people out of the economy, and so on. Harm reduction does things like stress needle exchange programs so that if people are using drugs, at least they're not transmitting to bloodborne diseases. It stresses public health education programs. It stresses peer education in schools. All of this stuff is being done piecemeal in different states, different cities, different localities. But there's no federal overstructure to this. The reason for that is the federal government, despite all the evidence that the war on drugs, which has gone on for 30 years at this point, just isn't working. The federal government is wedded to the old tenets of the incarceration-based approach of the war on drugs. And until we have a more rational public policy discussion about that, until we get politicians who are willing to really address the hard issues, does this work? We know that it creates good sound bites for politicians, but does it actually work? Does it actually serve to reduce crime? Does it actually serve to reduce drug addiction? Does it actually serve to reduce the harm caused by drug usage? Until we have a real public policy discussion on these issues, we're just going to be doing more of the same. So I would say that the key issue here is a more sensible approach to our drug policy. The other issue that has to be done is a better policy around mental health provision. At the moment, we've got hundreds of thousands of mentally ill people in the community who can't access or don't access mental health treatment while they're in the community. And then they get arrested because they commit crimes, and they get put into the criminal justice system, and then they get a rudiment of mental health care, but it's really bad, and it's not a good atmosphere to provide mental health care in. The health services inside prisons are under-resourced, they're not enough staff, and so on. So the other key issue here, in addition to drug policy, is to get a more sensible, holistic approach to dealing with the mentally ill and treating the mentally ill. If you can do both of those things, as a society, we're on the way back to creating a more rational, scaled-down prison system.
Well, Sasha, this has been another great conversation here today. I really appreciate you taking time to speak with us about American Furies and your work right here on the Audio Stash.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you again, Sasha. Sasha Abramski is an author. His newest book is American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. We have links to it on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.